The Guardian.
I'm Anushka Astana and this is Politics Weekly. The first major piece of Brexit legislation has cleared its first hurdle. A late-night vote produced a majority of 36 for the EU withdrawal bill's second reading. Opposition MPs called it an unacceptable land grab.
Mr. Speaker, this bill is utterly pernicious. It is dangerous. It is fundamentally un-British. And I think that it has at its heart a lie.
Over the top? Or is this government really trying to crack down on parliamentary scrutiny? And is this what taking back control really means? Plus, the government prepares to give way on some parts of the public sector pay cap after major pressure from the opposition, unions and voters. But will it be enough? We'll hear from Labour's Jonathan Ashworth.
In a public sector worker, on the median public sector wage, has seen the value of their wage drop £3,875.
But first, the EU withdrawal bill came before Parliament this week in the kind of Westminster late-nighter that could be a sign of things to come. A vote in the early hours of the morning was won by the government, and so the bill proceeds unamended for now. But minutes after the vote, there was a scramble by MPs, including those on Theresa May's Conservative side, to lay down amendments as they demand significant changes from the government. So what happens now? Ruth Fox is director of the Hansard Society. So we have a situation in which Dominic Grieve, who's the former Tory Attorney General, described the EU withdrawal bill as an astonishing monstrosity and then voted for it at second reading. Can you just explain to us what second reading is and why it is that so many Tory potential rebels voted with the government?
Essentially, second reading is the opportunity for members of Parliament to debate the principles and policy objectives of the legislation. So it's simply a debate and then a vote at the end to decide whether the legislation should go through to the next stage, the committee stage, which will be where members of Parliament get the opportunity, line by line, clause by clause, to look at the legislation in detail and suggest amendments to it.
OK, and there was a bit of a bum fight among MPs to get these amendments down. And I see there's already kind of 50-odd pages of amendments that have been published today. Why are they in such a hurry to get their amendments down first?
It's really about, I think, putting an early marker down about the key changes that they want to see, and it's particularly politics is about corralling support across the House for their particular amendment. The earlier they get it down, the earlier they signal to the government what they want, the longer they've got then to negotiate behind the scenes with the government about the terms of those amendments and to try and attract support across all sides of the House for them. Parliament's going into recess again for the party conference season, so the MPs will be away from the House and from each other for the next few weeks. So getting them down early and being able to corral up support over the next couple of days while the House is still in session is quite important.
And I don't expect you to have read 50 pages of amendments just yet, but do you have a sense of what are the key areas that MPs want to see changed about this bill?
Really sort of three areas. One is the nature and interpretation of EU retained law at the end of this process, if the bill passed into law. The second is the consequences in relation to devolution, to the devolution settlement. And then the third, and the one that I've got, the Hansard Society have got a particular interest in, is the nature, the width of the powers in the bill and the inadequate scrutiny procedures for them, particularly in the House of Commons. And we're already starting to see in some of the amendments that have been laid down. There's one, for example, from Dominic Grieve and John Penrose, as well as a number of other Conservative backbenchers, who are proposing the kind of strengthened scrutiny procedure for the statutory instruments that will follow from this bill to give effect in legislative terms to Brexit. The kind of strengthened scrutiny procedure for those that we at the Hansard Society have been calling for.
And just a final answer, Parliament for Dummies, if you don't mind. Statutory instruments that you're talking about are essentially the so-called Henry VIII powers that people talk about. The government wants the ability to tweak some of the legislation or the regulations as they come over without having to go to Parliament. Now, I know that amendment you're talking about talks about setting up a committee that would essentially sift through to find out where these powers overstep the mark. Do you think that would provide adequate safeguards?
Yeah, Yeah, I think it's, look, this is, if we were starting with a blank sheet of paper from the Hensoil Society's perspective, this is not where we'd start, but it's a pragmatic solution to address the scrutiny problems with the bill. And in essence, what you've got is a range of powers, some of which are Henry VIII powers, which essentially is a power in the bill that ministers can use to amend or repeal legislation that Parliament's already given effect to. And constitutionally, a lot of people feel that those are an outrage. So what we want is an additional layer of scrutiny on the use of those powers to ensure that ministers use them appropriately. You know, a lot of talk of this sort of debate has been about a power grab. It's a power grab in theory until it happens. The question for Parliament is what scrutiny procedures, what safeguards can it put in place to limit the prospects of that power grab ever being exercised by not necessarily these ministers, but future ministers. And we think essentially what you're looking at with possibly 1,000 or more statutory instruments that could arise from this bill, secondary legislation that needs to be looked at by both houses of Parliament, essentially what you're looking at is often for a needle in a haystack. So you need a sifting committee to look at those and to work out which are the politically salient ones, which are the ones that MPs are going to want to debate, and then have procedures in place to enable members to debate them properly and effectively.
Can you give me an example of the type of statutory instrument that MPs may want to debate?
Well, a good example, for example, would be the whatever deal is done on EU citizens' rights here in the UK and UK citizens' rights in the EU. That will, under the terms of the bill, will likely be settled through secondary legislation. And under the terms of the bill, as it's currently drafted, if members wanted to debate it, it would be very, very difficult. They would be dependent under the procedures on the government gifting them the time to do so. We don't think that's good enough. That's a politically important issue that clearly members of Parliament are going to want to discuss. We think there should be better procedures in place to enable them to do so.
Fantastic. So a win for the government, but it sounds like parliamentary fireworks to come. Thank you for joining us. Well, I'm now joined by our chief leader writer, Randeep Ramesh, Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk and also host of a podcast, Romaniacs, Jill Rutter of the Institute for Government, and our deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. Thank you all for joining us. So, Rowena, we went all the way through to the wee small hours and there was no Tory rebellion. In fact, a pretty solid Brexit majority for the Prime Minister.
Yes, it was a solid majority for Theresa May. It's probably a sigh of relief being breathed in number 10. There was only one Conservative MP who actually abstained on it, and that was Ken Clark. I don't think anyone would have really expected anything else, given his veteran pro-European attitudes. And Theresa May's majority was in fact bolstered by a number of Labour MPs who voted with the government on it. There were seven pro-Brexit Labour MPs who voted with the government, and then a handful more of deliberate abstentions. So people like Caroline Flint, a former Europe minister who supported Remain at the referendum, but she decided that it would be not respecting the result of the referendum if the opposition wanted to kill the legislation rather than try to amend it. And then there's another few like Ian Austin, a former minister, and John Speller, another former minister, who abstained. And it seems like those were deliberate abstentions as well, because they actually voted on a separate motion that night, on the programme motion.
OK, and Theresa May clearly, you know, breathed a sigh of relief. But immediately, MPs were queuing, jostling, we were told, to try and lay down amendments for the next stage. And there was a lot of talk about these Henry VIII powers. Jill, can you explain to us why so many MPs were getting worked up about these powers?
So why they're worked up is because they think the government will use these Henry VIII powers not just to do what the government said it's going to use them for, which is to make sort of small technical corrections to deficiencies in the law that we're importing over from Europe, but to make substantive changes and to implement the withdrawal agreement. So lots of the amendments that have gone down are amendments that are either trying to curb the scope of those powers, to say, well, you can use it for that, but it's got to be really technical, stuff like that, or ones that are suggesting a different and what you might call an enhanced scrutiny programme to say, if you want to use those, then actually you need to give Parliament a better say in how you do use them. And the procedure, which is the sort of the lightest touch procedure the government's proposing, to do everything by negative resolution, where actually the government gets to decide at the end of the day whether Parliament debates any of these, isn't good enough. So we want to have an enhanced one. So quite a lot of the amendments have gone down are restricting what you can use the Henry VIII powers for, and quite a lot are saying if you're going to use them, you need to give us these better scrutiny processes.
Randy, what type of laws are we actually talking about here? I mean, is it things like workers and consumer rights?
Employment rights are definitely part of it. Consumer rights will also be part of it. But the government has such a wide purview in terms of understanding what they decide can be regulatory in form, that I think Labour MPs will worry every time protections come under scrutiny, because they don't know what will be pushed through using this and what won't be, which is part of their problem. I think the government could enact sunset clauses, you know, ambushing MPs on regulations that they had promised that would stay for a longer period than they would. So I think there's a lot of anxiety on the backbenches, not just actually on the Labour side, on the Tory side too.
And in fact, not only on the Remain side, but among Brexit supporters too, Ian. I mean, you know, there was a time when we couldn't get the Brexiteers to shut up about parliamentary sovereignty. It's quite interesting that they aren't being quite vocal about this, but presumably behind the scenes, a lot of them are worried.
There's a few of them. I mean, Edward Lee made an OK speech yesterday where he sort of said, well, look, we need to be a little bit cautious about this. But the reality is, I hear really very little concern or anger being expressed by those who are most vociferous about their support for parliamentary sovereignty in the first place. Look, I mean, the most extraordinary part of the bill was Clause 9. I mean, Clause 9 basically says not only do we have all of these powers that we can use, basically turn ministers into their own little mini parliaments, but we can apply them to the terms of the bill itself. So that means that even the restrictions that they put in the bill can be undone by the very powers that the bill gives itself. This is, you know, one can't get too excited about this sort of stuff, but it is, of course, the kind of legislation that you would pass if you wanted to get rid of the kind of scrutiny and accountability systems that Parliament has. And it opens up the real danger area of modern democracy, which is where people say you can't know what the law is. We're now in the kind of territory with this bill where someone could legitimately say you can't know what the law is, because a minister on a rainy Friday afternoon when everyone's down the pub can just scrub out a bit of law and replace it without having to consult with anyone.
But Jill, is this really as sinister as some people are making out? There was some very, very passionate language in the House of Commons yesterday. I mean, the government would say there are so many pieces of regulation that need to come back. It is absolutely reasonable that we are going to need to tweak some of that.
I think that is reasonable. I mean, there is a massive body, and actually Parliament tied up legislating through primary legislation every little bit of EU law that we're transferring across that needs to be marginally tweaked would just bore Parliament rigid. That said, though, these are, if you like, I mean, you might even regard these as sort of government's opening bid as to just how wide can we draw these powers, knowing that we might be forced back either in the Commons and the Lords and still be left with quite a lot of powers. Some are very sweeping. I mean, the things, you know, that Ian was mentioning to amend this bill itself, that's, you know, quite an unusual sort of provision, and I'm not sure that that will ultimately stay in there. These powers are time limited, so I mean, the government said that they'll only last for sort of a couple of years after exit day, though of course the bill doesn't tell us when exit day is. Ministers also have the power to say when exit day is, which is another sort of interesting thing. Some of the amendments going down are saying that, you know, that you can't use this process to set the exit day. I think people suggest there might be multiple exit days, which is quite an interesting concept as well. So I think what we'll see is a real testing on the floor of the House when this goes to the Committee of the Whole House. It doesn't go to a standing committee, it goes to the Committee of the Whole House, of actually just quite how much power is the government taking. And then, of course, the people who really don't like this sort of legislation is the Lords. So the government's, you know, shaping up for quite long and difficult Lords stages, which it hopes to be able to start off in December with a new year. And that's going to be a war of attrition. The House of Lords Constitution Committee, which was praised in aid by Theresa May, has already produced a sort of rather huffy report saying, no, we really don't like loads of things about this bill. And here's a big list, and we're going to do loads of inquiries on it. So that's a sort of advance warning that this is going to have a very rough ride. And remember, the last time the government tried to take Henry VIII powers on a much smaller scale, but to abolish public bodies set up in primary legislation by secondary legislation, the House of Lords revolted and forced them to drop that schedule from the Public Bodies Bill in 2010. So the House of Lords got form on restricting the government on that.
OK, good to know that the Brexit vote meant that we didn't only have to become experts in international trade, but now in every technical piece of information about Parliament that we need to know. Rowena, the Tory whips were probably rubbing their hands with glee last night. They had this Brexit majority of 36, despite being quite worried about it in advance. I'm sure the champagne was opened, but how realistic is that going forward?
I think they'll be happy, as you say, that they've got a sort of overarching majority for the principle of Brexit. That's what they've established. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, there are going to be lots and lots of parliamentary battles to come when this legislation reaches its next stage. So it's not just about these Henry VIII powers, and I think that the government is going to be forced into concessions on that, because as we've discussed, it's Conservative MPs from both the Brexit wing and the anti-Brexit wing who are uncomfortable about this, as well as the opposition. But it's going to be it's an opportunity for people in both parties to try and soften the government's Brexit proposals. So on issues like the single market, the customs union, membership of Euratom, membership of Europol, there's going to be all sorts of little minor skirmishes on important issues that take place during the course of that. And the government's going to regard this as an attempt to hijack their EU withdrawal bill that they says does something very simple, which is transposing EU law into UK law, but it's going to be a proxy for all these other different battles over Brexit that are going on. So the government shouldn't be breathing an overall sigh of relief yet.
I'm sure they won't for long. Ian, Labour has managed to win over quite a lot of Remainers. I mean, that was one of the things we really saw in the general election. What would you say its position on the single market was?
Wow. I mean, if I knew that, I could make myself an awful lot of money. It is basically a positive attempt to create ambiguity in its position, insofar as it is conscious at all. There is another interpretation, of course, which is just that Jeremy Corbyn literally does not understand the core concepts which he is discussing. It's quite possible he doesn't know what the single market is. He repeatedly, as he said yesterday, says that single market membership is only possible for EU members. Now, that is objectively, factually false.
Well, Norway, except there is a technical argument here that Norway essentially gets access to the single market in every area apart from fisheries as a result of accepting the rules. So technically, some people would argue that Norway wasn't a full member.
No, I mean, technically, it's a member of the single market via the EEA agreement. I mean, it simply is, just as a point of objective fact. However, there's another interpretation, which is the one that they have tried to create this ambiguity in much the same way that the government itself has, which is to try and basically just hoover in as many supporters as they can by making politics a fundamental question about sort of tempo or about tune rather than about actual specifics in how you talk. And in that way, I think Jeremy Corbyn's been quite successful. He could say to the Remainers, look, I'm not as bad as the Tories, so you know, you've got a better chance with me, and the Lib Dems are never going to be in power. And he could still say to those Labour Leave voters in sort of post-industrial towns in the north, look, we're ultimately going to get rid of freedom of movement. Don't worry, somewhere down the line we'll take care of it. So it's been electorally successful, I think. The only real question is, has it been a conscious attempt to create that ambiguity, or do they just simply not understand the words that they're using?
I mean, do you think, Randeep, that they are to some extent squaring that circle? If you are a passionate Remainer, if you're worried about Brexit, pretty difficult to vote for the Conservatives?
I think Ian's got something wrong. He's right about something, which is that people want to hum the tune. They don't really know the lyrics. And that's really what Corbyn's doing, because he sees the political timetable in the same way the Tories does, which is say, first thing is they're going to have a Barney with Barnier. Next thing, they'll have a transition deal. And after that, we're leaving. And that's how he's played it. And actually, I know what I agree with Ian to a certain point, but really all they're really saying is, look, EU single market membership is an institutional form, whether it's EEA, EU, EFTA. And if you, I think reading between the lines, humming the tune, if you like, is really that he's saying, we're going to have a bespoke deal at the end of all this. We might have a transitional arrangement, which is basically what Keir Starmer is saying. We're going to have a transitional arrangement, which is going to, we'll be in the single market, which is EEA, EFTA, or some sub-EU membership kind of deal. And after that, all bets are off, and we'll be looking for a bespoke arrangement, which has what he says is access to the single market. And I think it's exactly the same as what the middle of the road Tory position is, if you like, because it's the politically viable path through the thicket of thorns that is Brexit. I mean, so that's really what's happening here.
And with that position, does Labour hold on to those ardent Remainers, or is there an opening there for the Lib Dems?
There may be. I think it's a timing thing. So in the next few years, that's where the Lib Dems will chip away at the Labour position, forcing them, as Labour are forcing the Tories into a more respectable, you know, more doable kind of Brexit. The Lib Dems will be forcing them into a more doable Remain position. So it's politics works, you know, as a series of poker hands, and each one of them are playing them. I think it's slightly unfair to say Corbyn's, you know, he's stupid or he doesn't understand these things. I think politics isn't about having this sort of vast intellect, Gordon Brown style brain. It's really kind of about dealing with the hand that you've got.
Or as one shadow cabinet member put it to me, studied ambiguity. That was the position. So they certainly thought that it was something they were deciding. Jill, we're having another battle in Parliament today, one that I expect the government will win again, but it has caused a bit of outrage. The idea that they are essentially going to fiddle the system to give themselves majorities on these standing committees, which are essentially dealing with, well, you tell me if I'm right on this, the very small print of this legislative detail. How common is it for a government to try to do this?
Well, I think the position is that that this is only really relevant when you have a position where you have a sort of technical minority government. And what the government would argue is, well, actually, we are a majority government because we've got a confidence and supply arrangement with the Democratic Unionists. So effectively, we have a majority, so committees should reflect that.
Can't the DUP be used on those committees to reflect that?
I'm not.
There's not enough of them.
And they may not want to be over from Ireland all the time. So so it's quite interesting because actually the thing is on this that this isn't relevant to this big Brexit bill because this big Brexit bill is not going anywhere near a standing committee anyway. So what it is relevant is I think we've had another month's finance bill reintroduced, finance bill number two. We are expecting the next seven Brexit bills. So where this matters is for those bills. Actually, in some ways, what's interesting in all the Brexit legislation is it's not immediately clear. You're just talking about sort of, you know, Labour leavers, Labour remainers, Conservative splits. It's not immediately clear, actually, that the party affiliation is the totally key thing when you're looking at the Brexit legislation, because MPs are splitting on different lines, the sort of normal ones. So the government will probably use the DUP. It will probably get its way on this. There will be bits of sort of outrage, but then we'll see them re-engage down the line. But this, as I said, only applies. So the last time you would have had any of this was when John Major lost his majority back in the mid to late 1990s. What was interesting, conversely, about the coalition was the extent to which the coalition provided a nice stable majority for everybody, because the government then had a working majority of 80 plus. It seemed rather like halcyon days. So.
And speaking of a lack of stability, Rowena, are we now back in the days of late night sittings, sick MPs being stretchered through the lobbies, all being brought in to win those tight votes?
It certainly feels like it, yes. And especially with the collapse of the traditional pairing system, which is where there was a cooperation agreement between the Labour whips and the Conservative whips, whereby if one of your MPs was unwell or indisposed in some other way for personal reasons, you could match up that MP with an MP from the other side and both agree that they wouldn't attend. But that deal that's been going on for a long time is no longer on anymore. So there really is a huge sense of urgency for the whips to get their MPs into the House of Commons, physically walking through the voting lobbies where there might not have been before. It's something that's going to lead to government ministers not being able to go abroad on official trips when Parliament's sitting for major votes, and so it could potentially slightly hamper the business of government as well.
Yeah, I did notice that Labour MP James Frith had come back 2 days after he had just had a baby, which made me think Harriet Harman was perhaps correct to suggest 6 months baby leave in which someone else could have voted for him. I would have definitely supported that. Now, Ian, just finally, what do you think they are making of all of this in Brussels?
It's the same old story, which is basically that they're waiting for someone on the British team to come across with some kind of coherent political attempt to resolve Brexit. Instead, what they've seen is a debate that is entirely domestic, both in terms of the way that Labour talks, in the way that the Conservatives talk, where really all of this stuff is for domestic consumption. It's this fantasy land of universal expectation of Britain just it wants and it wants and it wants, and it doesn't really address what its negotiating partner might be able to deal with or otherwise. I'm afraid that really what they're seeing here is still that same situation, Britain not really sure what it wants, not having any real majority in Parliament for hard Brexit, for soft Brexit, for Remain, and really unable to play any kind of positive or useful role in negotiation.
Okay, well, on that pessimistic note, we will leave that discussion there. You can follow this bill and everything else in Parliament on our rolling coverage at theguardian.com/politics. Now, the government is set to abandon the 1% public sector pay cap. Well, sort of. Police officers and prison guards will be the first to benefit amid concerns of recruitment and retention and following independent pay reviews. So are we seeing the start of a more general thawing of pay freezes across the public sector? Could teachers and nurses be next? And if not, are we on course for a winter of strikes and industrial action? I'm joined on the line now by Jonathan Ashworth, Labour's Shadow Health Secretary. So, Jonathan, you'll be leading a Labour motion in the House of Commons tomorrow. What is going to be the argument you're making?
Well, first of all, it is a motion that is in our name as the official opposition. But it's actually the wording comes from a early day motion from earlier this year, which was signed not just by Labour MPs, but by DUP MPs and MPs of some of the other parties. So we're calling on members of Parliament from both sides of the House who have spoken out about the public sector pay cap, who have expressed their concerns, their opposition to it, to vote for this motion tomorrow to send a signal to the government that the pay cap has to go. So, look, you know, DUP MPs have signed the EDMs, the same wording. There's no reason why they shouldn't be able to vote for the motion when we have the vote on it in the House of Commons.
And have you spoken to those DUP MPs?
Well, I've not personally, but I'm sure they'll have seen on the order paper that it's the same motion that they've put their name to.
And Jonathan, would you welcome the suggestion that they are going to lift the pay cap, at least in some areas?
No, no, I want the pay cap to be lifted across the board because I don't think we should try and cherry pick across the public sector. I mean, a public sector worker on the median public sector wage has seen the value of their wage drop £3,875 over the last 7 years. That's actually more than the cost of feeding the average family for a year. So I think the public sector as a whole needs to see the pay cap scrapped and given a fair pay rise. You've got to remember that public sector pay hasn't kept pace now with private sector pay. That was different. That was different when the public sector pay freeze was brought in. I mean, the government justified it by saying private sector wages were not rising at the same rate. Well, it is different now. Private sector wages are rising at a higher rate than the public sector, and we're seeing huge inequalities open up as a result of that. So these are the points we're going to be putting in the debate. But I know a lot of Conservative MPs have told their constituents that they agree that our nurses and our NHS workers and so on deserve a fair pay rise. I know many DU MPs have told their constituents that. So if we actually want the Chancellor to shift and abandon this policy, those Conservative MPs and those DUP MPs really need to honour what they've told their constituents and vote for our motion on Wednesday afternoon.
And there does seem to be a sign that they may pick out certain groups for pay rises. So the suggestion being, you know, remove the pay cap for police officers, remove it for prison officers because of specific recruitment problems. We know that the Prime Minister has come across nurses who've been very angry about their wages going down in real terms. So perhaps they'll take action on nurses. And the big fear, of course, is that they leave out perhaps some of the lower paid health workers, for example, in hospitals. If that were to happen, do you expect to see solidarity strikes across the public sector?
Well, I mean, first of all, this divide and rule approach from the government is completely unacceptable. A public sector worker on median wages based on what they were getting in last year will see their pay drop by about £2,200 by the end of this parliament if this pay cap remains in place. Every public sector worker deserves a fair pay rise. So we entirely reject this suggested approach of cherry picking, although we don't actually know the government's position because the government are actually all over the shop on this.
But if they do that, would you expect there to be industrial action?
Well, you know, industrial action is a matter for trade unions when they ballot their members. And of course, trade unions are perfectly within their rights to ballot their members and take industrial action. But that's a matter for them. I can't say I expect it or prejudge it. That would be a matter for trade unions. But I'm a Labour MP. We've always supported the right of people to take industrial action.
And will you, like your Shadow Cabinet colleague John McDonnell, be on the picket lines with workers?
Look, Labour MPs will support people taking industrial action, but these are industrial disputes. People will take industrial action for industrial reasons. They don't take them for sort of for political reasons or partisan reasons, and that's important to remember that when we're discussing these things. But look, you know, at the end of the day, nobody wants to see people go on strike. People taking strike action do so with a very heavy heart. They do so because they believe they haven't got any other option, and it's usually because discussions and negotiations have collapsed. That's actually why the general election, when we pledged as a party to get rid of the public sector pay cap, we also said that we would ask the independent pay review bodies to make recommendations, and we would allow decisions to be made through negotiations and collective bargaining. That is the sensible approach to deciding pay rounds, not what we've got at the moment, which is forcing an unfair pay cap on the public sector, or, as we think we might be moving to, this sort of cherry-picking, divide-and-rule approach.
Randeep, it appears that the government is going to lift the pay cap for some workers, which essentially is going to be them picking and choosing. Do you think that will be enough to respond to the anger about this?
No, I think it'll win them some headlines in some newspapers that they want to win headlines from. They've picked police and prison officers as people they can give money to. But remember that this is money from budgets that have already been allocated. So unless the budgets get bigger, all you're doing is robbing Peter to pay Paul here. And what will happen is that you'll cut the number of police officers. So that won't work for them. Unless the Chancellor decides to ease austerity and start pumping real money into it, you're going to see the public, you know, at first thinking, oh, great, more money. But they're not stupid. I mean, voters will understand what happens, and the unions and workers' representatives will be out there telling people this is a false economy.
And Jill, you've been in the Treasury, and clearly there has been some resistance in the Treasury to lifting the cap in order to offer this money. And, you know, the government often say, well, if you do that, then you are risking the kind of macroeconomic picture. But isn't this all about decisions? I mean, they did choose to spend money, for example, on their deal with the DUP. They do choose to spend money on changing the thresholds around, you know, different tax rates. Isn't it a slightly false argument from the government to essentially say that the pay cap is the kind of critical thing?
Well, the key thing I think here is that lifting the pay cap generally is extremely expensive. I mean, the government has managed to keep a lid on public sector pay for 7 years. I think Nick McPherson at the weekend, the former permanent secretary, said that ultimately pay caps become unsustainable. You just can't do it. But you just need to think about, if we're going to do that, what decisions are we going to make differently? So 1 billion on for the DUP, obviously they found that from somewhere, and those sorts of figures are lost in the rounding, but public sector pay is quite big money. The key thing about lifting the cap on public sector pay is the immediate beneficiaries are obviously public servants. So where you see service pressures, it doesn't immediately directly translate through into an easing of service pressures. So it might do, you know, if you can use them in quite a sensible way to deal with problems. So, for example, we've just highlighted the fact that there are different problems in prisons to in police. In prisons, the problem is they've actually got the money to attract in new prison staff, but they can't recruit, and they have great retention problems, and retention churn is actually quite expensive. In the police, there's a different issue, which seems to be low morale. The number of days lost sick, which also hampers productivity, has gone up quite a long way in the past few years. So if you can do things with public sector pay that start to address some of those problems, or say in the NHS can reduce your dependency on agency workers, then you might be able to square the circle of spending more on pay, but actually not just seeing it not translate into any sort of service improvement. So government needs to actually work out what it's doing, why it's doing, making sure that if it does lift the cap, it's doing it in a way that actually generates service benefits as well.
And Ian, this was quite a big deal in the election. A lot of Tory MPs told me that, you know, nurses or teachers essentially said, we can't vote Conservative because of what you have done to us. And they are itching to see their wages, you know, significantly increase. John McDonnell has talked about offering solidarity, I'll see you on the picket line type stuff. I mean, are we in for a winter of discontent?
Yeah, it's possible, though you notice that they even, you know, we've had what seems to be an upcoming announcement on police and prisons. There's been very warm words, for instance, from Jeremy Hunt towards the nurses, suggesting pretty strongly that the same thing will be happening in their case. So again, this attempt is there to just try and present really aspirational promises towards people without really giving them the details afterwards. Now, one of the details is to confirm that you're doing it. The other one is, as was said earlier, to confirm where is that money coming from? Because if it comes from within that budget, in a case of nursing, you're just going to get ruined really on waiting times or on hospital equipment for services which are already stretched, for instance, by the departure of foreign nurses in the wake of Brexit, by the increase in the price of buying drugs and machinery that is produced overseas, by the decline of sterling. So those core situations are unchanged. And at the moment, the attempt to address the winter of discontent is entirely a PR attempt rather than anything to do with concrete policy. If it really is going to change, it'll be with something more specific that is produced by the government.
And just finally, Rowena, the Conservatives, it may seem politically astute for them to act on this, particularly given inflation and real-term wage reductions, but they are actually massively ahead of Labour, or they were in the election, with private sector workers. And presumably they'll be a little bit worried about what that looks like as well.
Possibly, but it does feel like there's an argument about fairness going on at the moment. And there's a question over whether people will look around, private sector workers will look at what's happened to public sector pay and think, you know, is it necessarily fair that there's been this 7-year pay freeze going on at a time when private sector wages have started to recover a little bit more. The gap between the two of them has started to narrow. So it feels like most Conservative MPs are worried more about the public sector voters in their constituency than resentment by private sector workers after such a long time of austerity that was first imposed in 2010.
OK, well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests, Ruth Fox, Jonathan Ashworth, Jill Rutter, Ian Dunt, Randeep Ramesh and Rowena Mason. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.